Well, it's now my distinct pleasure to introduce our last speaker, Dr. Kate Myers. She's retired from the University of Washington, longstanding member of our community. And she's worked for 30 years as a research scientist with the High Seas Salmon Research Program. Her research has been focused on open ocean ecology influences on immature Chinook productivity and abundance trends. And today she'll speak to ecology of Alaska Chinook salmon in the open ocean.
Could you start that up for me?
I will.
Oh, here we are. I don't do Windows. I do Apple computers, so there we go. Well, first of all, it's great to see everybody. There's a lot of people that I consider my friends out there and colleagues out there in the audience, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you a little bit today about ecology of Alaska Chinook salmon in the open ocean. I think we've covered this pretty well already. Why is the open ocean important to Alaska king salmon management? And It's more of a life stage than a place, because as we've seen, Chinook salmon are moving in and out of coastal areas throughout their different life history stages, coastal and open oceans. But salmon are spending most of putting on most of their growth when they're during this older life stage that might take from 1 to 5 years in the open ocean. Sorry about that. It might surprise people, but high seas researchers do look to local and traditional knowledge from fishermen to generate hypotheses about what's going on with salmon in the high seas. The fishermen are the first ones to see the adult salmon returning to the river, and they're seeing changes in abundance, body size, diseases, parasites, and scars. And the two leading hypotheses for things that might be causing declines of Chinook salmon in the ocean are climate change and fishing. So how do Alaska king salmon respond to ocean fishing? There's a long history of open ocean fishing on Alaska salmon. The black line at the top of the chart is showing the historical Japanese high seas salmon catches. These were drift net fisheries that ended in 1992. But the peak catches of this fishery were probably something around, these are landed catches, around 900,000 fish in the early 1980s. And since that time, with the closure of the high seas fisheries, obviously these catches have dropped. But we didn't really see, if you look at the commercial catches from Western Alaska and Russia, for example, we really didn't see a big response or increase in abundance of fish, at least in the commercial catch after the high seas drift net fisheries ended. And to put it in perspective, these catches, the green line down at the bottom is the BSAI bycatch. So how do Alaska king salmon respond to climate change? We've already heard a lot about cycles of cool and warm temperatures in the North Pacific and Bering Sea. And these cycles can last for periods of 30 years or so. But in recent years, we've been seeing more high-frequency variation, and so shifts back and forth between extreme cool or extreme warm conditions. So how did one of the interesting questions is how are these affecting salmon on the high seas? So with some funding from the AYK SSI, we had a 3-year project that was starting to look at some of the ecological processes that might be affecting abundance of Chinook salmon on the high seas. And some of the, this is very basic research. We just were looking at the basics of distribution, horizontal and vertical, salmon food habits, salmon growth and bioenergetics, and climate ocean effects on the salmon and their habitats. If you're going to do research on Alaska salmon in the open ocean, the two primary habitats, the areas where abundance is highest, is the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska at this large scale. But we do know enough about their distribution now to have identified some of the critical habitats, and this example is for kings in the Bering Sea. We already heard a lot from Phil and others about the intertidal habitat, and although that's not an open ocean habitat, that is a huge information gap, and I really would encourage a focus of research on nearshore habitats. The Aleutian Basin is the central Bering Sea gyre, and that's where older life stages, Western Alaska salmon, spend their summer feeding. They migrate into the Russian EEZ during those life stages, and we don't know very much about what's happening to them when they're inside of the Russian zone, and especially in terms of fishing and bycatch and marine fisheries. There's lots of stock identification data available to build some conceptual models of where salmon are migrating in the Bering Sea. This is an example of coded wire tag data. The blue triangles are mostly coded wire tag recoveries from the groundfish bycatch, and the yellow tag recoveries are from high sea salmon research. And they show, even though there's very few tags, they show the basic distribution of fish, Yukon fish in the Bering Sea. And from these data, we developed a conceptual migration model. During, we've heard a lot about the juveniles in the coastal area. So during their first summer and fall at sea, they're in this coastal habitat. In the winter, they move southward and eastward, and they're distributed along the Bering Sea shelf break. In summer, they move offshore, and they're distributed over the Bering Sea basin. And then, of course, adults return back across the shelf to their home streams. And there's a lot of techniques that you can use to validate these models, and this is just a kind of an elegant example that Wyatt Fournier did for his thesis work at UW, that showing that stable isotopes, which reflect the feeding of the fish over much longer periods than diets and tell you something about the habitats that they were feeding in. So when you see depleted levels of carbon isotopes, it indicates that they're feeding further offshore than when the levels are enriched. And here we see that the summer samples in yellow, the fish were feeding further offshore in summer. And then the blue samples from winter, the fish were feeding more in shelf habitats. And there's also, you see variation between the age groups, and it looks like the fish are moving closer inshore as they age. We don't have conceptual models, detailed conceptual models for Cook Inlet fish, but they appear to be one of the most widespread stocks. There's even one recovery off the Oregon coast from a hake fishery during an El Nino year, and they extend into the northern, central Bering Sea. And this, the tag recoveries really aren't showing the westward distribution of stocks because they're mostly, most of these Cotabar tag recoveries are coming from the trawl fisheries. And then just for, by way of comparison, here's the tag recoveries for Southeast Alaska stocks, and they have a more eastward distribution, but also extending into the Bering Sea, particularly in the summertime. Chinook salmon have an extensive vertical distribution, and this is what makes them susceptible to bycatch in the trawl fisheries. And this is just a summary of depths of trawling where Chinook salmon were caught by the fishery. And it looks like all of the age groups are distributed at all of the different depths. Individual records for individual fish show an incredible amount of variation and activity in terms of their vertical migrations throughout the day and seasonal differences as well. This is one recovery from a Yukon Chinook salmon that shows about 2 years of data. The surface, the depth is in blue, and the surface is at the top of the chart there. And you can see that during its first winter after it was tagged, it actually stayed below the surface at about 100 meters depth. That kind of behavior would definitely make you susceptible to bycatch in the trawl fisheries that are fishing at around those depths. What do they eat in the ocean? Well, we have a pretty extensive time series of summer data from surveys aboard Japanese research vessels, and the salmon are feeding primarily on squid, fish, and euphausids. And we see odd even year variations in the prey content in the stomachs, and this has been hypothesized to be related to pink salmon abundance. In the Bering Sea, there's some pretty dramatic cycles in abundance of wild Russian pink salmon between odd years and even years. We made use of the trawl bycatch to do the first studies of winter diets of salmon in the Bering Sea. And one of the, maybe it was a black swan, a really unexpected result, was that we found that the salmon in winter were feeding on pollock offal. So perhaps the fish are actually following around the processors that are discarding waste, processing waste at sea, and feeding on those, on that offal. One of the other important winter prey for Chinook is pollock itself, and so these kinds of ecological interactions bring up the question of whether the pollock fishery is acting as both a predator and a competitor. And I hope that people, I know it's important to look at the numbers and what the bycatch numbers are in terms of direct mortality, but there also might be a lot of indirect mortality associated with these ecological interactions. This is an example of summer diets of immature kings in the Gulf of Alaska from our Waukatake Maru survey data. Those surveys are still going on, by the way, and I think, if scientists are interested in going out and sampling in the open ocean in the Gulf of Alaska, it's a great experience to go out on the Shoal Maru. And they're always willing to help people collect data, samples and data, tag fish, whatever you want to do. There's a large component of unidentified stuff in some of these samples, and I think a lot of it is marine debris, plastics, and that type of thing. So the fish are out there in the Gulf of Alaska, gyre feeding on plastic, and so another important thing to look at might be to start taking a look at what plastics in the diets of fish in both the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea, what effects they're having on Chinook salmon. Here's just a simple model of how climate change might affect, or how salmon might respond to climate change in the Bering Sea. So we've seen these fluctuations in abundance between warm years and cool years. And during a warm climate, you might expect high survival, high growth rates, and early maturation, early return of adults, younger and smaller age at return. And about the opposite during a cool climate period. And then if you were looking at the Gulf of Alaska, you might see the opposite, that it's really the cool climate periods that are beneficial to survival. We've done some bioenergetics and growth analyses, and I won't take a lot of time to talk about those, but some of the results were that immature kings respond to cool and warm climate regimes by changes in body size. The first winter at sea is the most critical growth period, and it's affected by warm versus cold climate change. Female Yukon kings showed a positive shift in their growth around 2000, but we didn't see an equivalent change in abundance, so this might just have been a density-dependent effect, fewer fish, bigger fish type effect. And climate ocean variables that were correlated to increased high seas growth, some of the important ones were low sea ice cover and warm temperatures. I'll just show a couple of data slides to back up some of those results. This is showing regime shift changes in a time series of Japanese research vessel samples of age 1.2 female kings. And the biggest shift was related to the famous climate regime shift in 1977. And the fish increased by a size of about 1 inch between those cool and warm periods. And we've seen shift back to smaller sizes for quite a long period. The last shift on the slide is not statistically significant, but if we had extended that, it would probably show a shift downward. These are the results from tracking adult female Yukon kings through cold and warm climate periods in all of the different life stages throughout their marine period. And the only period where we saw really significant changes between warm and cold periods in growth was that first winter at sea in the southeastern, along the southeastern Bering Sea shelf. And this supports the hypothesis that we were talking about earlier, the critical period hypothesis. Here's the scale measurement data, showing a shift in 1999 and 2000 in growth, and that extends all the way back to freshwater growth. So I know Greg Ruggieroni has done studies showing that there's a correlation between freshwater growth and later ocean growth, and you can see it in this data time series. So we did some modeling with Nate Mantua and his grad student to look at how climate changes of 2 to 3 degrees centigrade would affect thermal habitats of Chinook salmon in the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea. These 2 to 3 degree centigrade changes that are forecasted for with climate models are similar to what we saw with the 1976-77 regime shift. So those temperatures also changed by about 2 degrees centigrade in the high seas areas. Anyway, the summer changes were not significant, but the changes during the summer changes were the significant changes, and the models predicted that we might see about an 86% loss of habitat by the 2080s. So if there was ever going to be any more funding for open ocean research, I think there's a lot more work that could be done on hypotheses about human forcing of open ocean ecological processes and how those are contributing to long-term declines in productivity of Alaska Chinook salmon. And the area that I think would be the most useful to focus on are human effects on open ocean growth and survival of Chinook salmon. A lot of people have always viewed high seas research as being interesting information and nice to know, but we really can't do anything about it. So if we try to turn the focus to some of the human effects, we might make some real progress and in the process learn more about the open ocean ecology of the fish. So the four main areas would be climate change and ocean acidification effects, industrial scale fisheries effects, not really focusing on the bycatch mortality, but focusing more on the ecological interactions. And then hatchery-wild interactions. This is a huge area, and people have avoided thinking about it because there's plans for dramatic increases in hatchery production in the North Pacific, both in the Gulf of Alaska, Alaska salmon, pink salmon stocks, and as well as in Russia. I think Russia's hoping to put a lot more pink salmon hatcheries online to build up their production. And we think that there are interactions between pink and Chinook salmon on the high seas. And marine pollution is one of those invisible things that nobody's really wanted to look at. But we do know that salmon are feeding on plastic in the ocean, and plastics contain BPAs and other chemicals that ultimately will affect the productivity of the fish. And it's very important to do modeling to look at the multiple effects of these stressors on the fish. What are the cumulative effects, and how are they affecting the fish? It's not just one factor that's happening. And I'd like to acknowledge people that have recently funded research, high seas research, particularly the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative. There's many co-investigators who've participated in our research over the years. And of course, none of the stupid things I just said are the responsibility of NOAA or any of the funding agencies that do fund our research. And Joe Spader asked me to put up another ad for their outreach workshop that's going to be happening in December. And I hope everybody will be able to attend that one as well. Thank you.
This is Katie Howard, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. You talked a little bit about some of the research you did in collaboration with the Japanese research vessel, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the research that the Japanese scientists have been doing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there's a decline in high seas salmon research funding, and so the long time series that I showed you from the Wakatake Maru survey, that survey ended. They've shifted their efforts to a trawl survey along the same line, but it only covers the Bering Sea. The original Wakatake Maru survey covered both North Pacific and Bering Sea. And I know that there's opportunities to go out on those Japanese vessels. The best way to get connected is probably through Nancy Davis at the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. She's the deputy director and has extensive experience and contacts with the Japanese researchers. So if you do have an interest, an opportunity, I really encourage it. I really encourage all the young scientists out there to get interested and involved in high seas salmon research, because there's a huge gap there now. Another survey would be the Ashoro Maru survey, which goes on in the Gulf of Alaska almost every year. It's a training vessel for Hokkaido University, so there's always a lot of graduate student participation on the vessel, and it's a lot of fun.
Oh, hi, this is Jim Murphy. Actually, Katie kind of asked the question. It was kind of like, what's the future for some of these Japanese research surveys? Maybe I could expand on that. Is there anything that, so you have the Ashoro Maru survey and some of the other Japanese surveys, but is there any way that we can utilize some of the data or keep from having those time series kind of be lost?
As part of our AYK SSI project, we created a legacy database that essentially includes all of the high sea Chinook data that we had available to us, and that includes U.S., Canada, and Japanese data, as well as some Russian data. It includes catch and effort data, food habits data, growth data. So AYK SSI has that data set now, and we hope people will use it for their research, and we hope people will add new data to that collection. One of my big concerns are the high seas scale collections. We have an extensive collection of scales that were taken on the high seas. And right now they're at the School of Fisheries, and they may stay there. We've been working with Ted Peach, who's the manager of our fish collections, and I think he's interested in bringing those samples into the Burke collection. And then those samples would be available for genetic studies or growth studies, whatever. So we're being very careful that no information is lost.